want a podcast? I got a Smodcast. You want a podcast? I got a Smodcast. You want a podcast? I got a Smodcast. You wanna? Do you want a podcast? Do you want a show? Do you get your laughs from computer radio with this bro, Scotty Mo? It's about time to lose your shit. Everybody, spark a spliff for that legend, Kevin Smith.
Welcome to Smodcast. I'm Kevin Smith. Okay, kids, this is a good one today, man. When you're an artist, you get fed like everyone else by other artists. You know, if you like entertainment, if you like making movies, TV, singing, fucking writing, you know, it. Oh my God, it's a big ass bee in here. It's very rare that you do it isolated. You know, I'm sure there are some geniuses out there that literally just like, I fucking have no influences whatsoever, but, you know, I came into my own or something. A lot of us do what we do because we see other people do what they do, and their work feeds our work. Case in point, Chasing Amy, there's a scene with Jay and Silent Bob at the diner. And, you know, having a conversation with our main character, Holden McNeil, who is going through some girl problems with his girlfriend, Alyssa Jones. And at one point, Jay utters the immortal line. It's like Cube says, life ain't nothing but bitches and money. That and in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, while the Jay and Silent Bob are hiding out in the diner when Marshall Willenholly comes looking for them. Right before they know that the cops are outside, Jay breaks into a bit of Fuck the Police by NWA. So the guy I get to talk to today informed what it is I do. I mean, it sounds weird to say, but he's in the DNA of my characters now. And borrowing from him and lending that credibility to my characters has made them a strong kind of fabric within the world of pop culture. And it's given me a borrowed credibility where people are like, oh, he knows the work of NWA and Ice Cube. And this is going back to, you know, of course, the 90s. Now everybody does. But I never got a chance to thank him. I will never forget sitting there writing that script and wanting Jay to say something cool. And I was like, I know exactly what that will be. It was because Jason was a hardcore NWA fan. So it wound up in my work, man. And today I get to talk to a guy who's responsible for that. We're going to talk about many things, but we're going to talk about weed because, like me, he entered into the weed space, and like me, he entered into the weed space with the same company, with Caviar Gold, Caviar Mike, who makes our Snoogans and Snoochie Boochies and Berserker. He came up with his own joint called Good Day, and it's tasty and it fucking smokes fine and shit. All caviar weed does. Welcome to Smodcast. This is more honor than I feel my house could bear. The Great Ice Cube. How are you, sir?
Yeah. What's up, Kevin? How you feeling, man?
Oh, incredible. You know, above ground, for heaven's sakes, and smoking. So that's
good. It matters, shit, at the end of the day.
Yes. Now, we were going to speak earlier, but Cube was like, I'm going to go see my pops, and which endeared you even more to me. You know, a man who realizes the value of his parents, you know, that's everything. A lot of people, of course, have seen the movie about a portion of your life and stuff.
Yeah.
My question, though, is kind of related to that. When you're a young artist, and particularly in the case of you guys, you know, you're definitely not adhering to the norms of like, well, I do this, I do this, I do everything right. I abide by what my parents say. Did you have a tight relationship with your parents when you started breaking?
Yeah. You know, I've always had a good relationship with my parents. You know, I always appreciated my pops for staying and sticking there and being there for me. You know, a lot of dudes, fathers, you know, felt it easier to, or, you know, they couldn't, for whatever reason, stay in a relationship. But my father stayed there. He was a big influence. So, you know, it was always love and positivity, you know, when it came to me and my family. When I started doing music, they was happy for me. You know, they was happy that it was something positive. You know, I began playing football and shit. So they was happy anything that was keeping me out the streets. So when I started doing music, you know, the music is hardcore and shit. So my mom's was like, you know, her church friends and shit was showing her the kind of records I was doing.
Right.
So she, you know, she asked me, you know, why you gotta be the one to do all the cussing on the records? You know, why you can't make clean raps? I said, I got some clean raps, but I said, don't nobody want to hear that. You know what I mean? They want to hear what's real.
Right.
And she would be on me about those records, you know what I'm saying, until I showed her, you know, the little money I was making at the time.
Right.
And then, you know, I was bringing home gold records and hanging them up in her house and things like that. So they was just straight proud of me, you know, like, I'm not in the streets. I ain't tripping, but I am, you know, doing something that's getting recognition and positivity and putting plaques on her wall and giving her a little change. And so the church ladies seemed to shut the hell up after they saw it. It was a positive thing. You know what I mean?
Yes. I had a little bit of that when I made Clerks. My mom was like, you know, the first, her review of the movie to me was, you spent $27,000 on this piece of garbage. And I was like, thanks, Mom. Very Carol Brady of you. The moment my mom was interviewed by Entertainment Tonight at like the Clerks premiere, you've never seen someone more proud. She's like, well, I could do without the language. Her big thing, because she was also very, very churchy. Her big thing was like, everybody's going to think that I taught you this language. I was like, that'll make you look cool amongst my friends, Mom.
No.
What was it like, and what does it continue to be like? But going back to when you guys broke, what was it like to be the voice of a generation?
Well, I mean, it's incredible to be heard. It's incredible. You know, I never looked at us as the voice of a generation. I looked at us as doing what we do. What's a trip is we had just kind of, you know, swallowed the fact that we was just going to be neighborhood stars. We was going to be hood stars. We wasn't going to be, you know, Run DMC. We wasn't going to be EPMD and, you know, just the big groups. So as soon as we kind of sunk in, let that sink in and just absorb that, that's when everything blew up and it just started taking off. So always was proud that I was on the same stage with LL Cool J. I was on the same stage with Slick Rick, Public Enemy. That to me was the accomplishment. I never looked at it like, oh, damn, we the voice of a generation. I always felt like we doing what we supposed to do. We showing the world what the West Coast is all about, you know, along with Ice-T. You know, but it was other groups. It was King T. It was Compton's Most Wanted. It was a few other groups, DJ Quick, you know, so we were just, to me, like spearheading a movement, going behind what Ice-T had. You know, Ice-T had laid, you know, some foundation for us that we can kind of slide in on. So, you know, I just felt like we was doing our part. You know what I mean? It's not till afterwards I look back and then see that, yeah, we was speaking for a lot of people who couldn't or just wasn't going to come from this angle.
Were they the way in for you? Was Ice-T the way in? Because, like, you and I are roughly the same age, and I'm 50, you're 50-ish, right? Same thing?
Yeah.
And I was, of course, nowhere near the West Coast and growing up in the fucking suburbs of New Jersey, but I was a massive rap fan. So we must have been into, like, roughly the same things around the same time. I remember when Public Enemy first broke. Prior to that, of course, like, it was just all Run DMC for me. They were the top. But then there were bands like Stetsasonic, Audio 2. Did you listen to them as well?
Yeah. You know, I've been on tour with them too as well, you know, so it's cool. We was fans of all the East Coast groups. Like, they were pros to us. And we were like locals. We considered ourselves locals. You know, we weren't known nationwide, worldwide. So, you know, those were what we were aspiring to be. But Ice-T did kick the door in. He worked with a lot of groups in New York. He was friends with, you know, KRS-One, Zulu Nation, him and Africa Islam. Which I think Africa Islam is from New Jersey. So, you know, or New York, I don't want to get it wrong and shit. I don't know. It might be from one of those boroughs, but at the end of the day, Ice-T was going on a Dope Jam tour. So he was actually touring and taking West Coast hip hop nationwide and kind of, you know, softening the people up for NWA. You know, I think without Ice-T, NWA would have took a little longer to break. Yeah, for sure.
I remember when his was the first taste of like West Coast rap that I'd had, and I remember when that I was a cassette guy. So I remember when that. I was a tape guy. I remember when that cassette came out, bought it and listened to it. And his lyrics were, they had taken it up a notch. Boogie Down Productions, KRS-One, Scott LaRock, they were the first like rappers that I remember were very specific about like my nine and guns and stuff like that. Up until that point, it was just, you know, it was everyone throw your hands in the air, wave them like you just don't care. Or me and Chris.
Eazy-E would play Criminal Minded all day long.
I'm going to embarrass myself by doing Boogie Down Productions. We'll always get paid. They'll take the wackest songs
and make them bad. Remember.
So let us into your skin, because then you'll begin to master rhyming. Criminal minded, you've been blinded. Oh my God, he was, I think, my first favorite lyricist, KRS-One, because it was so based in language. Everything was like rich language. Like, don't get me wrong, I love Run DMC, but. You know, me and Chris Rock would always, like, Chris Rock's also a big Run DMC fan. So when we started working together, like, Run DMC was something we bonded over. And, you know, Chris, I think, was the first one to be like, look, they're amazing, but let's be honest. Like, you know, he's like, the next thing you know, you'll have a big car is not the most winning lyric in rap history. He goes, does the job for at the time. But he's like, you know, lyrics got much better after that. KRS-One's lyrics just like changed my world in terms of like,
oh, it changed the game.
Yeah. Did it really?
I mean, he showed that one MC can have 100 styles. You know, it wasn't about you know, finding your cadence and just rocking your style, and that's it. He showed that you can have many different styles on a, you know, and so it opened it up. It opened up your imaginations of how many different cadences you can master, you know, and still rhyme on time. And, you know, so KRS-One was a big influence, you know. It's like, I just think, you know, up until probably, man, I don't know when KRS-One wasn't an influence, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you even talk about, you know, the Blueprint album, you know what I'm saying? I mean,
the day begins with a grin and a prayer to excuse my sins. Yes.
Some crazy, crazy work. And, I think I've seen him rock a show, you know, KRS-One. Like, I seen him stand at the front of a stage like a real MC and just rock the crowd. And that's always been impressive to me. You know what I mean? He's a real one.
When first time you got to share a stage with somebody who was, you were a big fan of, you know, somebody, I can't believe we're here. Who was it?
Man, it was Heavy D and the Boys. It was Salt and Pepper, UTFO. Yeah, we had a show with him in San Diego. Guess who else was on that show?
Who?
MC Hammer and Too Short. First time we met Too Short and MC Hammer.
Get out of here.
Yeah, down in San Diego. And, you know, we have been doing local shows in L.A. And here, you know, this tour was going through San Diego. UTFO tour was going through San Diego. And it had Salt and Pepper on the show, Heavy D and the Boys. And then we, you know, we was opening up, too.
So wait, you guys opened for them?
Yeah, we opened for them.
And did you open with the first album?
I don't even think we had the first album out. We just had dope ass singles out, you know, like
right.
Easy album was out. Easy Does It was probably out, but we had like Dope Man out, Gangsta, 8-Ball. So we had singles that were, you know, enough for us to do a 25-minute, 30-minute show.
Was it a tone shift for that audience from you guys to then, like, now Salt and Pepper, Heavy D and the Boys?
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. But Tupac was on there, too, with his little dirty mouth. So between us and Too Short, I think we balanced everything out. But I know the East Coast groups was really tripping on us, you know. They was just, you know, I remember Heavy D's just saying, damn, man, how y'all get away with that? How y'all get away with that? And, you know, we didn't know no better. We was like, man, this what got us on the fucking road. If we were still doing, you know, regular raps and shit, we probably wouldn't be here. So we going to stick with it.
When you guys were like, we're going to push the line, this is what we're going to rap about. Clearly it's going to upset some people. Is there any fear behind it? Or you're just like, no, or was there ever a moment where you're like, maybe we shouldn't go as far as we do?
No, it ain't no fear behind it because we had already started it.
Mm.
We were doing mixtapes just for the swap meet out here, Rhodium swap meet. So we was just doing hardcore cussing and shit on the mixtapes because we felt like it wasn't going on the radio.
Right.
And we could talk about the neighborhood because we wasn't trying to sell records in, you know, Philly. You know what I'm saying? We just talking about the neighborhood. So let's keep it about the shit that's going on around here. So those got popular. Those got real popular. As a matter of fact, Easy had a tape when he reconnected with Dre. Him and Dre knew each other in high school, but they reconnected once Easy started hearing these tapes on the street, like, who's doing this? It's Dr. Dre. And they he probably didn't know who I was at the time. So he started coming around. You know, this is like 84, 85. He started coming around us. And he wanted to be a manager. He wanted to get out the dope game. And so he wanted to manage his group. It was his group out of New York. He thought, I'm in L.A., but I know these kids from New York. I need to work with them so we can actually be famous and shit. You know what I mean? So it wasn't no real, like, big L.A. rappers at the time. You know what I'm saying? Just, I mean, Ice-T was on his way, but everybody was still finding our way. So I wrote a song for him. And they turned the shit down. You see it in a movie called Boys in the Hood. And,
yeah.
And Dre convinced Easy to do it. And rest is history. But so we was like, you know, Easy let us do those kind of records where, you know, we was with this dude named Lonzo, who was a cool dude, but he was more into slacks and horseshoes. And, you know, he was into the Barcades and shit. And right. Into... you know, Confunction and these bands, these funk bands and shit. And he wasn't really into rap. You know, first thing he said was like, who the fuck want to hear about somebody going to jail? You know what I mean? That's what he used to clown this bitch. Like, nobody want to hear nobody rapping about going to fucking jail. And he's like, this will never catch on. You know what I'm saying? So
it's so funny like, Easy, to think
Easy
about.
Was like,
it's so funny to think about now that somebody was like, you like lyrics that people could relate to. Why do you think that would work? Like there was a whole audience not being spoken to who could then yeah. hear their lives reflected in your work. That's groundbreaking.
Yeah. It was good shit at the end of the day. I mean, we didn't think we was going to go too far cause it was so much cussing on it. So we felt like our records was going to be, they used to put Eddie Murphy, Rich Pryor, Red Fox records in these sections called the Blue Section. And we thought our records were going to be with the Dolomite records and shit. Like in that Blue Section. We didn't think it'd ever make it to the regular, you know, front of the store rack. And shit, it did.
That quick. Was, yes. Fast. When did, you mentioned Boys in the Hood before, when did acting come into it? Because did you act in high school or anything or no?
No, I never even thought about acting.
Who was it? John Singleton who approached you or what?
John Singleton is the first one to come at me about it. He said, look, man, I got a movie you'll be perfect for. And I said, what's your movie called? He said, Boys in the Hood. I said, hey, man, that's what. What are you talking about?
Yeah. My lawyer will be contacting you.
He said, no, it was inspired by what y'all did, but it's a story about the neighborhood. I wasn't half listening to him. You know, I was just at the time trying to be the greatest rapper in the world. And that was like laser focused. So he pursued me for about 2 years. And finally, you know, a script came to my manager and I had forgot about John. I forgot all about him until I walked in and saw him sitting there. And I'm like, this got something to do with you? He said, yeah, remember me? I'm like, yeah, I remember you, man. And then, you know, he just helped me become an actor, you know, straight up. He helped me, you know, through the process between him, Cuba Gooding Jr., Lawrence Fishburne. You know, they really helped me stay on my feet and not, you know, fucking fall flat on my face, you know what I'm saying?
It reminds me of I put Jay and stuff because I'm like, oh my god, like I'm gonna write a part around this person. It sounds like John did the same thing in your case. Did you find like did you have to act or was it close to your persona?
Well, I mean, it was close to my persona. But to be honest, I could have played any three of those characters. Like,
yeah, especially with the football and stuff.
I grew up with these dudes. You know what I'm saying? It was like dudes from my neighborhood, clearly. Like, so, you know, I could have did any part. So it was great, man, you know, just to have a movie. I remember reading the script and I had my wife read it. And after she finished reading it, you know, we was both blown away. Damn, I only got 10% on my goddamn battery. We was both blown away. I might have to plug up some real. We was blown away, and I was like, damn, how we grew up is worth a movie. It's movie worthy.
You know, says the guy who was singing about how they grew up. Like,
yeah, I mean, I thought we could make raps about the shit, but like a movie. So, you know what I mean? That was kind of cool. I'm going to have to move you, man. I'm going to have to move.
No worries.
I got to plug up over here and shit. So, about to go for a ride.
Happy to do it. I remember when that movie came out, like, of course, John's story as the filmmaker who came from film school, like, you know, who said to an agent, like, all the movies you guys make are bullshit. You need to make something real. And, you know, he put his money where his mouth was and wound up making Boys in the Hood. So naturally, you know, that was one of those stories that as a young filmmaker, you're like, yeah, everything's possible. Anything's possible. But that movie was massive, tapped into the zeitgeist, was talked about everywhere. And it's also a really wonderful and watchable movie. At that point, what was... Because you worked with John later on in Higher Learning and probably other things, right? How many times you worked with John?
I just worked on Higher Learning.
Just those two?
Yeah. We were supposed to do Poetic Justice. I was supposed to do Poetic Justice. But I'm glad Tupac took that role. You know, I just didn't feel right about the role. So I'm glad Tupac took it.
Did you really, like, there was a moment where he presented it to you and you were like,
he wrote it for me.
Really?
He wrote it for me. Yeah. Yeah. And we just couldn't agree on a certain part of the script. I just didn't like the fact that, you know, don't get me wrong, Janet Jackson is fine as hell, but I wouldn't throw out my homeboy for on the side of the road before we got to Oakland. You dig?
Right.
You know what I mean? I don't care if we did get into it. So I just felt like I don't want to play a character that kicks his homeboy out for a girl he just met.
Fair enough.
And he didn't want to change the part. So I said, give it to Pop. Mm-hmm.
What was he like? Because you worked with him as the young director, the guy who kind of broke on the scene. Was there confidence?
Commanding.
Really?
He was always commanding. Yeah. He was always commanding, man. You know, he turn this shit on, get a little more light. Yeah, he was it was a trip just to see him take control over the set. You know what I'm saying? It was just a trip to see him take control.
Because of his age?
Yeah. You know, I had been on video shoots, but, you know, to see somebody that young, this is my first film set. So, you know, I'm thinking, you know, there's people there older than him. I know they've been in the business longer than him. But he was the man. I appreciated watching him do that. You know, I learned a lot from him when it was time for me to do my movies. To know what you want, and fight for what you want. And you know, don't let too many people, you know, it's like it can't be a director by committee. You can listen to everybody, but at the end of the day, you got to be the one directing that bitch.
Now,
or, you know, or let the director do his thing.
Now, you mentioned it before, you eventually went off and did your thing. In a world where you didn't think, you know, the albums would go to the front of the store, let alone the top of the charts, let alone into legendary, iconic, legacy position in the world of music. You didn't see yourself becoming an actor, but then it happened. When did you start? Was it while you were acting in other people's movies? Is that when you were like, you know, I can do this as well? When did you get the idea for Friday?
Shit, from John Singleton. You know, I was with him at his house. He had just bought a new house in Baldwin Hills. And I went over there to see him. I would go over there and watch movies. You know, he would put me through film school and shit. Like, we would watch and see what's good movies, what's bad movies. He showed me shit like A Clockwork Orange and, you know, Stanley Kubrick, 2001 Space Odyssey and shit like that. He would, like, you know, just show me what was a good movie versus a bad movie and why. And then one day, I just popped over and he looked at me one day and he was like, man, when you gonna write a script? I was like, damn, John, I'm just now trying to learn how to act, man. You know, let alone write a fucking script. He was like, man, I don't want to hear that shit. He said, if you can write them kind of records, I know you can write a script. That day, I left his house. Me and Kim, we went down to, it was a fucking Mac store on, like, in Century City, right there on, like, Santa Monica or some shit. We went right there. I bought a Mac computer. I bought Final Draft. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I just went home and I just started writing a script. It was bullshit. Don't get you. But he helped me through this clunky way of writing, you know, with no note, just kind of just off the dome. I didn't really know how to do it. So he worked with me and, the script was readable. It wasn't great, but it was readable.
Was it Friday?
And I got the bug.
Was that script Friday or no?
No, it was a script called America Eats Its Young.
Where is it?
It's probably somewhere buried on one of my laptops around here somewhere.
Do you ever want to revisit it as the first thing that you wrote?
No, it's garbage. It's not good. Not good, I know. Then I wrote a script called Defense with a guy named Floyd Metrix. And he's the guy who wrote some of the first Cheech and Chong movies. And, I learned the process a little better working with a bona fide writer. You know, John is a writer director, so he's writing to direct. This guy writes just right, you know.
Knowing that it's going to be handed off to somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. So I learned the process, you know, by writing that second script. And then the third script I wrote was Friday with me and DJ Pooh. You know, we was fans of the Cheech Chong movies, fans of Hollywood Shuffle.
I love brilliant Hollywood movie. Shuffle. Nobody ever talks about it. Robert Townsend's movie, man.
Yeah, brilliant. Robert Townsend.
Winky Dinky.
Brilliant movie.
He was one of the people responsible for me eventually doing what I do, because I remember hearing him interviewed by Howard Stern when I was still, like, working at the convenience store. Well, that might have been when I was still in high school, because I have this vague memory of me being in the parking lot of the school. But it was him talking about putting his movie on credit cards.
Yeah.
That was the first time I'd ever heard that notion. I was like, what? And I was young, and it was years before I would ever make a movie, but I was like, that's possible? You could do that sort of thing? And it went and stored in the memory bank so that years later when I was like, oh my, I'm going to try to make a movie, I'm going to put it on credit cards, I pulled directly from that DNA because I knew it had successfully been done before. And I love that movie. That movie's hysterical.
I mean, Robert Townsend, you wouldn't have Friday without Robert Townsend.
Is that right? Now,
yeah, because of the inspiration. You know, his inspiration and doing Hollywood Shuffle the way he did it and how good it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, I plucked John Witherspoon from seeing, you know, he used to do these HBO comedy specials too. You know, I think called the Undercover Brother. You know, it was like some kind of Robert Townsend's, criminal. Yeah, it was
memories of that, of the cover of the box, the VHS box.
Yeah, you know, you would have Patrice Rushen and shit coming out doing the music. And so, you know, him doing that kind of stuff, Kenan doing In Living Color, like all these inspired me and Pooh to write Friday. Also, like Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society, South Central, Colors, like everybody thought living how we grew up was just pure hell. Right. Like it was no fun. So me and Pooh was like, man, wait a minute. We had fun growing up. Let's show how we would envision this kind of shit going down in our neighborhood, you know? So that was a big draw too, to show South Central wasn't all bullets and war zone, even though it is fucking drive-by shootings and Friday, but it was the tone of having fun through all the chaos and not, you know, it could have been a heavy drama. You know, Friday could have actually been a heavy fucking drama. You got, you know, the neighborhood dope dealer want to kill us and shit. You know what I'm saying? But we wanted to flip that. And we actually was like, this shit got to be hood, but it got to feel like Home Alone. It got to have that fun, bright, I want to be there feel. You know, not drib, drab, I'm ready to run out the fucking theater. You know what I'm saying?
It's a wonderful, hysterical flick. Where did Chris Tucker come into it?
It's a trip because nobody wanted Chris Tucker in the movie.
Really?
Really.
What year is this?
Pooh was supposed to play Smokey. Pooh. DJ Pooh was supposed
to play Smokey. So you guys wrote it together play the parts.
Yes. When New Line acquired the script, they said, well, you know, that's a lot of dialogue for somebody we don't even know. You know, Pooh never acted before. You know, he did it a few of my videos, but that was it. So they pushed real hard on you got to find a co-star. You know, they was actually talking about, you know, Tommy Davidson and people like that, who, you know, he was hot at the time. I said, no, I want an unknown. I don't want you to know who this person is, really, because I want him to be Smokey when you see him, fucking Smokey, nobody else. You know what I'm saying? So I didn't want none of the known comedians that was already hot. But I had seen Chris Tucker on Def Comedy Jam. And then they put him in House Party 3, but they gave him like
tiny part.
I said, oh, they fucked up. That kid right there is a star. So I pushed him on the studio, made him fly him out, get an audition. F. Gary Gray was even like, man, why? Who is this kid? I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I said, let us just audition together. Because the shit I seen him do on TV, if he can do that here, it's a wrap. And once we got down together, they saw the chemistry. They saw, I mean, everything he said was funny. And that's how he got the part. You know, I fought for him to get it. Because I knew, you know, I just knew that this is the kind of kid that I want to play next to him, because he reminded me of some of the dudes in our neighborhood that was crazy, you know? Yeah.
What? So first produced screenplay, third screenplay written, first produced screenplay, and produces a like a instant classic with phraseology that enters into the pop culture lexicon and beyond the pop culture lexicon, the lexicon. There are people that say "Bye, Felicia," don't even know why they say it.
Yeah, without a doubt. I got to give credit to Pat Charbonnet, too. If you look at the credits, you'll see Pat Charbonnet.
Mm-hmm.
She was my manager at the time. And she was the one who really, you know, the script was, you know, very pregnant.
Right.
She helped us get it into shape. Helped us find the financing with New Line and helped produce the movie. You know, so, you know, she's an unsung hero on this Friday. You know, I guess call it legacy or classic movie. You know, so without her, you don't get the movie as tight as it is.
Are you going back in? Is there another Friday in our future?
Well, I'm actually trying to get the movie out of Warner Brothers.
Is that what I saw? I saw something. It popped up in my feed. So what's the idea?
They fucking around. You know, in his New Line, it's Toby Emmerich over there. Well, he runs Warner Brothers now, but it's a New Line. Fucking, you know, me and New Line own it together.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they got the rights to put the fucking shit out. So, the end of the day, I wrote two crazy scripts, like, for the last Friday. One they just wouldn't do. You know, it was before cannabis was legal.
Right.
So, it was about... It was right in that era where it was state, but the feds were still fucking with the dispensary. So Smokey but Craig and Day, they had a dispensary and shit. And the motherfucker got, they had a flash mob in there, stole all the shit. And, you know, we end up fucking up some kids in there going to jail. In jail, we see all the motherfuckers that we put there, from the Joker Brothers to Debo to Damon. And our whole thing was trying to survive in fucking jail with these motherfuckers, like, locked in with us. Then we sent to a rehab. The rehab, you know, I had Smokey running the rehab. And it's a fucking scam. It's bullshit. You know, they was back there smoking all the dope they find on people. So, you know, it was to me great for the time. And then motherfuckers was like, well, this is before like any of these shows that came after this, but yeah, they spending too much time in jail. Nobody, you know, jail's not really funny. You know, all this bullshit. Then after that, all these fucking shows come out like Let's Go to Jail, Orange is the New Black, all this bullshit come out. And I'm like, you motherfuckers, see?
You were
ahead of the curve.
You were, finger on the pulse.
Slow me now. So that was the first fuck up. So I wrote a whole nother script that was perfect. I mean, and for whatever reason, they was like, well, the love story part, I don't really understand. I'm like, you don't understand? What the fuck? What are you worried about the love story part? That shit is minute in this whole story. It's so small. What are you holding up a whole fucking franchise for dialogue, basically? You know what I'm saying? So it was all bullshit. stall. Then John Witherspoon passes away.
Hmm.
Rest in peace. And then Tiny passes away. So I want the fucking movie back. You know, I just want my shit back. And I can go make my movie. They just don't know what the fuck they doing. And this is the same studio that wouldn't do Straight Outta Compton. They turned it over to Universal because they thought it was just a rap movie.
Right.
And they wouldn't do Ride Along because they didn't think me and Kevin Hart could do a hit movie together. So they had Ride Along for fucking 10 years.
Are you kidding?
They let Universal have that one. So fuck, they don't know what the fuck they doing.
What are your chances of getting it out?
Great. Shit. You know,
I mean, especially if they're not going to move forward with it. Like, number one,
I don't know why they're holding it.
Number one, let's go back to the fact that the first script you wrote just should have been greenlit, predicated on how much money you've previously made the studio with the other Fridays. So right then and there, like, you walk in with a script, you know, as long as this is a sequel to fucking Friday. There should be no boundaries. And as the creator of the material, it's like, if you're like, it's in jail, then they should have just been like,
great. They wanted to tell me what needs to be in the Friday movie.
And how did that feel? I mean, how nuts is that?
It don't make crazy man sense.
It seems silly because it feels like they're just leaving money on the table.
They are.
And so hopefully, they either come to their senses and be like, just go here, go. Or they're like, you know what? Take it. God bless. But it's not a good look to hold on to it and not do something.
No, man. You know, they're holding the happiness of the culture hostage.
That's a good line. That's good. Well,
and they are.
Boy, you're good with the words, man. You should write lyrics or something like that.
One day.
That is, that's frustrating, but I hope to God it works out for you. But I'll tell you this much. I wouldn't call it schadenfreude or whatever, but like, it makes me, like, at my level, which is way below your level, it makes me go like, Jesus, it's hard up there. Like, I would just assume you walk in and you're like, you don't even get day out. You're like, fry. And they're like, here's the fucking money. Go, go, go. Because you could just keep doing it. Like, you know, as long as people were interested, particularly the creators and the original cast. So
what's fucked up, Kevin, is they beg me to write these things.
And then don't make them.
And then don't fucking make them. So I don't know what it is. You know, it just seems, it's very odd, strange. Can't put my finger on it. You know, at the end of the day, they just fucking with me. You know what I'm saying? You know, they bug the shit out of us for me to write these things. I wrote two scripts and they sat on their hands for no reason.
Time to go, for heaven's sakes.
I wouldn't do a movie with them motherfuckers for nothing in the world.
And you have been, this is Warner Brothers? Because New Line
Warner
is
Brothers.
Owned by Warner Brothers.
And
you had been in Warner Brothers stuff. Three Kings was a Warner Brothers movie, right?
Yeah, I've been in a few of their movies.
I mean,
a few of their movies. You know, it's like, I don't understand, you know, what they thinking, but it's not working for me.
Can I ask you a off-topic question just because it came up and I was like, oh, shit. And I'm just stoned enough to ask. On Three Kings, there was that story that George Clooney punched the director. Were you there?
It was no punches thrown.
There were no punches thrown?
No.
But you, so
it
you
was
were
just intense, head-to-head, I'm about to fuck you up kind of.
That kind of energy, like, let's go.
Yeah.
But nobody actually threw.
Nobody threw a punch.
Had you ever seen that sort of intensity on a movie before?
Not between the director and the actor.
That would
have that big.
That would have scared me off forever. I would have been like, oh, I never want to see that.
That ain't shit, man. Man, I done seen crazier shit than that.
Is that right?
That was entertaining.
That was what?
Entertaining.
Entertaining. You've seen like directors and actors like really get into it, or?
No, I just seen people get into it, you know, at shit, at events.
Oh, like in real life, not on a movie.
Yeah,
set.
In real life. That's so true. Then somebody get into it on the set ain't going to do nothing for me. You know what I'm saying? As long as they keep that shit over there.
Totally. I hope you get it back. Again, it just makes no sense for them to let an asset that they know will print money. It's not even like, man, I don't know if we want to take a risk on this Friday picture. It's like they know it's going to make money no matter what it is. But, you know, if the creator of the material says this is what it is, just go. Take the journey. Like, you know.
John Witherspoon died waiting on this movie, hoping, dreaming, wishing to do this movie. Not only him, you know, you got all the comedians. When they do a Friday movie, it gives them a bump for 5-6 years, man. You know, so it's just, it's sad for these people to just sit on this material and let great, you know, stars that we love pass away. Tiny Lister passed away. You know, it's about seven people from the Friday franchises that's no longer with us. So to me, it's just, you know, it's almost time to take this shit to court. Yeah.
Do it. Get yours. Get it back, for heaven's sakes. Those are your characters, man. Think about
that. Man, it's the culture.
But also, like, you're right. The heartbreaking aspect is, like, we won't get John Witherspoon because somebody dilly-dallied, because somebody was like, well, this ain't Friday, to the guy who made Friday.
Man.
Crazy.
That's what's crazy, that if you saw a picture of these dudes that's holding up the movie.
I know what they look like.
Yeah, man.
Speaking of Friday, because I know I can't keep you forever, it ties into Good Day. In as much as, you know, of course, our heroes in Friday are preoccupied with weed.
I mean, this Good Day?
Oh, look at that shit. You know, since I mentioned earlier, we share a connection in Caviar, Mike. I got a box of that shit early, and oh my God. Isn't it great?
You do what it's supposed to do, right?
Yes, it absolutely does. How
awesome.
I
got that Friday Kush too.
Look at that shit. What is that?
That's that Friday Kush, man.
So
I got the Friday and the Good Day.
I didn't have the Friday. All I had was a Good Day, but I'll have.
Gotta get you a box.
I'll get it. I'll go down to Herbarium and get it. When did it come out? When did you street? Like last month? I saw your billboard in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Man, I think we went out in February.
Mm-hmm.
I believe February. I think it was February. I done lost track of time and shit.
We have
fucking
been
COVID.
Yes, we have been in a pandemic twilight zone. So what does it feel like to smoke your own weed?
It feels great. I ain't gotta roll this shit.
I know. The beauty of the pre-roll.
And you know, we work, I mean, I'm pretty sure, you know, my man Caviar, you know, he I'm pretty sure I got on his nerves and shit, because, you know, I kept sending him back to the drawing board and shit, you know what I'm saying, till it was perfect to my taste. And, you know, we fucked around for about a year.
Coming up with the strain.
Getting it perfect, you know. And so I'm more than happy with it. You know, everybody I give barely can finish.
Yeah.
You know, you can't finish a whole one. I know you can't.
It is.
You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah, they're pretty intense joints, the Caviar joints. If you're a stoner, those are the joints that you smoke to get high. Because, you know, normal flower will just, you know, keep you level. But Caviar, the infused weed, is like, it's just very intense. I took
next level.
I took mine on tour with me when we toured Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. And so I had it for 4 months straight, and wasn't able to mix it up with just plain flour and stuff. So it's pretty heavy stuff. There's something called the Caviar Challenge where, you know, if you can smoke one of their joints all the way down in 15 minutes, you win like $1,000 or something like that. But
yeah, it ain't gonna happen.
It's nearly impossible. The Good Day. I thought it was Good Day because it reminded me of Boys in the Hood when you were like, that was a good day. Where'd you get the name from?
Today was a good day.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? That's like, Today Was a Good Day is one of my biggest songs. You know what I'm saying? If I don't perform that shit, it'll be hell to pay in concept. You know what I'm saying? So I just felt like, you know, when you want to blaze and shit, you're trying to turn, just trying to turn it into a good day. So, you know, to me, it was perfect name for the perfect product. I was waiting to put the name on something that was right. So, you know, Good Day and Friday, it just, you know, I don't think you could say that without seeing my face. So, you know, that's really what it's all about. You know what I mean? Making sure that it's a name people remember, and people feel comfortable with, know that, that I ain't just throwing no shit out there, that is something that I'm really behind. So, you know, we just want to see it grow.
What states can they get it in? Right now, just California?
Right now, it's California, Nevada, Oklahoma. Goddamn, one more state.
Florida, Illinois?
No, not that far. It's West Coast. It's, Washington? Know, I've been putting this shit too much. No, not in Washington.
Too much smoking your own.
Yeah. I've been hitting this too much. But we in four states, and it's been doing great.
Of course.
It's been doing great.
I mean, it is like, again, they make impeccable weed, but like, you know, you branding it makes a big difference as well.
We in New Mexico, I believe.
Is in New Mexico?
I believe so, yeah.
You've got like Christmas gifts galore, man. You know what everybody's getting for Christmas. They're all getting some Friday. They're all getting some some Good Day.
There'll be nothing wrong with that.
There'll be a Christmas Day strain. That's what everyone's getting.
Yeah, we need a Christmas Day.
It's an insanely wonderful, varied career you got, man. They call people like you Renaissance men. Like, you know, it's you could have fucking just done one thing, which you did insanely well, to break onto the scene in the first place, to introduce yourself to the world. And then you just kept diversifying. You kept like going like, this seems interesting, and followed a bunch of different paths, man, which, you know, as I'm sure you know, but for the audience at home, that gives somebody options. You know, like, you can't be defined by one thing. Your definition is all the things that you do at this point. To some people, you'll always be a rap legend. To some people, you're a movie star. Now to some fucking people, he's the dude on the weed I smoke.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, it's, you know, what I don't want to be is a jack of all trades, master of none. Yeah, you know, I don't want to be that. You're
pretty good at all of them, though, so far.
I mean, I won't do it unless I know I can do it well.
Mm.
You know, so I do take advantage of opportunities, but only if I can do it well. Because one thing I don't want to do is disrespect the game, and that's any game I get into. You know, I want to respect the game, do what I'm supposed to do, and work hard. And then the outcome should come out in my favor. But so that's really what it's all about, is, you know, not just doing everything, but seeing what you can do, challenging yourself, learning the game, and then doing what it takes to try to be the best. And so with that philosophy, I've been able to jump into a few different fields. And, you know, I feel blessed, man, because not everybody can do it.
Listen, kids, you've just heard the secret. You know, everyone wants to know, what's the secret? Ice Cube just literally laid out the secret for you. It's a treasure map. Follow literally what he said. And you'll be able to self-express on some level. Maybe not to the level he's reached, but hey, you know, it begins someplace. Like you heard the man say, he didn't know they were going to be racked in the front of the store, let alone he was going to be a screenwriter, let alone he was going to be an actor, let alone he was going to be a legend. You directed already as well, right?
Yeah, I directed a movie called The Players Club.
Yeah, yeah.
I directed a couple of documentaries. I directed this shit for 30 for 30 ESPN.
Mm. You did one of those?
Welcome, yeah. It was Straight Out of L.A. I did Straight Out of L.A., which is talking about the Raiders leaving L.A., back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've done a few things when it comes to directing. It's really, you know, just about, you know, making sure you take advantage of your opportunities. And follow your heart. Stay creative. You know, that's what I really want to say. Stay creative. You know, it doesn't matter if you get paid for it. Just be creative, because good things happen when you create, when you're creative. And you also can get shit that's inside of you out. Sometimes putting it on a paper, writing it down in a poem, in a rhyme, in a whatever, drawing, painting, sculpture, you know, just being creative opens opportunities on all kind of levels. So that's what we was doing, and look where it's gotten me. You know what I mean? Just being creative.
Mm. You ain't going to get better advice than that all year, kids. And you got it from the great Ice Cube, man. Ice Cube, thank you for taking the time.
This was fun, man.
It was a good time, man. And again, that weed is fantastic.
Yo, man, we got to do this again.
We will do it again.
You know, you're going to have to hit me up with a couple of your boxes. I had a couple of your boxes I ran through. Yeah, I need some more.
I know the feeling. I've blazed through yours as well.
Need some more.
That's it, kids. That's Smodcast for this week. I'm Kevin Smith.
Your boy Ice Cube.
Have a week.
This podcast has been produced exclusively for members of ThatKevinSmithClub.com.